Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Michigan Avenue Media. A good story is a good story. Hosted by Marsha Casper Cook. Live shows every week with interesting interviews in the entertainment field with writers, producers, directors, and screenwriters. There's also shows about newsworthy topics and group discussions about writing tips to help writers reach success. New to the show are conversations about personal struggles and how to feel good about yourself in today's world. One thing's for sure, it's always a lively conversation and lots of fun. So sit back and enjoy the show.
Morning, everybody. It's Marsha Cook, and we're going to have a great show. Catherine Lane is on, but I will say that we're lucky to be on. I'm sure anybody out there has already heard that there's outages. So far, so good. So we'll stay on. And I used another number that they gave me. So otherwise, we would not be on today. Mine wasn't working. So we'll hope that gets better. And Catherine has a lot to talk about. And she's a wonderful author, but she's also had a personal struggle, and here she is to tell us all about it. Catherine, I'm so happy to have you.
Well, Marsha, it's such a pleasure to be back on your show. It's
been a while.
We tried to get a show together before
yep.
I had brain surgery, and we had to postpone it until I was fully recovered, and here I am.
Yes, thank God. Knock wood. I mean, and so tell everybody, before we get into, you know, all your books and everything, the struggle that you went through to be here is important because a lot of times people are out there and they don't know things that could happen to them that have happened to you and could be prevented, possibly. So do you want to talk a little bit about what happened and what occurred? Because, yeah, you were, this has been a year already, I think. When was your surgery?
My surgery was 6 hours, and I was under anesthesia a little bit longer than that, obviously. And then my recovery was, they told me it's a full year and a half because of the type of brain surgery that I had. Mm-hmm. But they did tell me the first 6 weeks would be the most difficult, and once I was past that, then my life would start to improve. And yes, the first 6 weeks were very difficult. But let me tell you, Marsha, the reason I like to talk about this is that I had no idea when I was diagnosed with a brain aneurysm that I didn't know that it ran in families, and I did not know that 1 in 50 people in the world walking around with some sort of aneurysm in their body. Now, that does not mean that they will have an aneurysm that will burst. They could live their entire life and never even know that they had an aneurysm.
Yeah.
But for those aneurysms that grow, it is a very dangerous proposition for the individual, because if the aneurysm bursts, the likelihood of surviving and surviving well is very, very
thin.
Yes, it's practically impossible.
How did you know you were sick? I mean, it's, you know, if there are symptoms that people don't know about, what happened to make you aware of what was going to happen?
Most people don't have symptoms, but there are a few symptoms. One of them, the one that alerted me that something was wrong, was that I had double vision. I was sitting at the computer and I was working.
Yeah.
Just from 1 second to the next, I had double vision, so I assumed I was having some sort of stroke. But I felt okay, and my husband wasn't home at that time. He had gone to breakfast with some friends, and I didn't want to call him until I knew, you know, is something really serious here? My vision came back perfectly okay, and at that point, I stood up. That was, I guess, 10 minutes. I stood up, went to the mirror, did all sorts of tests in front of the mirror to see if, you know, it was obvious that I'd had some sort of stroke. Stood on one leg, stood on the other, said, what day is it, you know, and all sorts of things to myself, and I seemed to be making perfect sense. Called him anyway, and we went to the emergency room, and he said, you have not had a stroke, but we have discovered that you have an aneurysm in your brain. And like I said, that is unusual. Normally, you don't get that kind of advance warning. There is one other symptom that I had for several years, and they think that it was definitely from the time that the aneurysm had grown to. It was only a medium-sized aneurysm. Normally, they don't become dangerous until they're larger. And don't ask me what large is. They measure the, of course. And,
measures.
Measurements. But I had had visual migraines. Now, visual migraines do not hurt. You just get these squiggly lines that come about, and you see them in, if they're in your, you know, in your line of sight. And what I would do when I would get one, and I had asked my ophthalmologist, you know, why am I getting this? And he said, well, you use the computer a lot, and you need to take more breaks. But they had become worse and worse, and I told him, and he didn't think that there was anything the matter with me. At that time, he should have sent me in for a CT scan, but he didn't.
Yeah.
Later, I discussed that with him. And he said, yes.
So was this this was an ophthalmologist, not an optometrist, an ophthalmologist.
Yes, that was an ophthalmologist, yes.
Yeah.
So then when they discovered the aneurysm, they sent me into the hospital, and I spent two nights there, and they did extensive studies. And then they said, because it is on the low end of a medium-sized aneurysm, it's not as if you need to do something immediately. And this was in early November, okay? It was the 3rd of November. And they said, why don't you, they said, if you want to, we need to have you go through an angiogram, which is where they go in through the groin and come up through the arteries and through the heart and into your brain to check things out and take pictures. Well, I said, can we hold off on that until after the holidays? I want to get through New Year's, and then you can, you know, do all the tests you want. And they agreed. They agreed because it wasn't at that point something that was terribly urgent. Well, what happened then, Marcia, I rewrote my will. I, you know, prepared myself emotionally, spiritually, you name it. And then on January 5th, the neurosurgeon did the angiogram. And the results from that showed that it was a far more dangerous aneurysm than we had originally anticipated. Once he got the up-close enlarged picture, it was not just the aneurysm that was balloon-shaped. It had a couple of little legs sticking out of it, which make it a lot more dangerous because it's more likely to burst. So,
burst,
of course, at that point, we need to get you into surgery sooner rather than later. And then again, I said, can we wait a month? And the doctor said, yes, I think that a month would be okay, but certainly I wouldn't let it go more than about 6 or 8 weeks. So then in February of last year, February 7th, I had open skull brain surgery because the angiogram had revealed that the location of it could only be treated through open skull brain surgery. Yes, because there are times that they can go in with another angiogram procedure and do what they call coil an aneurysm. But my it just wasn't possible because of the shape of it and the location where it was on the artery going into the brain. So the surgery itself, I had a wonderful team. There were 13 people on the team. That included the neurosurgeon, his assistant, and then there were three people that were just monitoring my brain waves because it's such delicate surgery. And these, and let me just take an aside here. You know, there are so many things going on in the world, and a lot of people are very anxious about everything. But the one thing, the one area where I think we can point to wonderful advances in medicine, you know, medicine has come a long way, and I'm a living example of it. So in the operating room, they had three people monitoring my brain waves because the clip, to clip off, they don't cut it. They just put a titanium clip on the aneurysm, not right next to the artery where mine was, to cut off the blood flow going into the aneurysm. And I will live with that the rest of my life, that little clip there.
Right.
And then,
well, thank goodness they can do that.
Yes, they have to have the brain waves monitored, and apparently absolute silence in the operating room so that the neurosurgeon and the brain wave technicians can coordinate everything so that that gets clipped at precisely the right time so that you don't have any brain injury caused by the brain
waves. Yeah, because it's a delicate surgery. Right, right. And, you know, we see all these things on television, but these things are real. You know, a lot of people think, oh, it can't happen to me. But, yes, anything can happen to anybody.
Absolutely, and that's why
none of us know.
I do like talking about this because I want to make people aware that if aneurysms run in a family,
that's something that I'm sure people do not know. Because
that
I don't,
is correct.
That's not information, right? So someone in your family had it.
Well, my neurosurgeon believes that my grandmother at that time, of course, in Mexico, no one knew about aneurysms. People died of massive strokes, and it was because aneurysm.
Yeah.
And they just, fell over and passed at that, very quickly.
Yeah.
And because 7 members of my grandmother's family, herself and her 6 siblings, all died of massive strokes. The neurosurgeon said that's too much of a coincidence. At least at least 3 of them would have had aneurysms, and that would have caused their massive strokes.
Wow.
So, of course, now I told my brother, told my son, and I, every time I give a book presentation, I've given 8 so far this year, and I just, at the very end, I don't go into as much detail as I'm going into here, but I have said, this is what happened to me, and if you are aware of any history of aneurysms in your family, whether they're in the stomach or in the heart, I said sometimes they can just be monitored, and you don't ever need to have surgery. But if you need surgery, you need it, because otherwise, if it bursts, you're not going to be around for very much longer.
See, that's the thing. A lot of times, there's such advances in medicine that, it's extremely, for me, like I was worked in hospitals and clinics and labs, and, so many of the things that people have now and are getting help for, they didn't have that before. And, and some of the tests, but one of the problems is that a lot of people don't go to the doctor. They're scared of going to the doctor at all. They don't get checkups. And I might say that a lot of these doctors, now they don't give thorough exams. They don't. It's a whole different thing. And so that's another problem that people, if you don't like the way your doctor is, or you think he's neglecting you, well, maybe he is, or she, and because they're on a time limit now when they do physicals, which they never used to have.
Because there are patients that are going to, if they take a little more time, they might find something out about what's going on in that person's life. And I agree with you. And you used to be in the medical field. So you are a very good voice.
And I watch it now, and I see this. And, we've had shows on breast cancer. I've had a lot of different things. But, people, a lot of times, they don't want to hear it. They're scared. But you need to know that things can happen, and that you should check yourself out. But like with an aneurysm, it's true. Most people don't get to the spot where you are because they don't know. And that's what happens. These things are silent.
That's correct.
And then it's too late.
Let me also tell you, Marcia, in the U.S., all the large cities do have very good neurosurgeons and neurologists.
Yes.
In other countries, depending on the country, people may not be so lucky. In fact, I researched the doctors. That was one of the things I wanted to do when I realized I was going to have open skull brain surgery. I wanted to research the doctors very carefully, and I got some answers from someone who works with, obviously she's an operating room nurse, and she knows all of the good neurosurgeons, and she gave me some references, and I checked them out, and I interviewed three of them, and I decided on the same man that I had seen at the hospital. And he was born in Pakistan and moved to this part of Texas, North Houston, better known as the Woodlands, where we are. He had moved here when he was 6 years old. And he has people, as do a lot of neurosurgeons in the Houston area, he has people that come from all other countries that do not have this kind of service. And this kind of surgery started becoming available. The first surgery, I think, took place in the mid-1990s. So it's been around for a few years, but certainly not for a very long time.
They've improvised, and they know what they're, if you go to a good doctor, you hope, we don't know, and we don't also know what's in our body that would affect what surgery. So that's why you have to really go to someone that does a thorough exam of what you are. And a lot of these doctors do. The specialists are in this country are really good. It may be a lot of times the general practitioners or the internists that could miss something. But once you get to a specialist, you hope that they know everything that there is to know about that. And I think a lot of them do. I think they take the time, whereas your own doctor, they don't, and that's going to be a problem. So I'm hoping that they'll figure something out with that, because everybody knows somebody that's had some horrible story about something that could have been checked. And so in your case, this is great that they found it, and you're well, knock wood.
Oh, yeah. And let me tell you, Marcia, that last year, in between the angiogram, which was exploratory to see how they were going to handle and take care of the aneurysm, between that, which was January 5th, and then February 7th, when I actually had the brain surgery, I had a book that was published, and it's a stolen diary, and it's not in the Nikki Garcia series. It's a standalone book, although I'm getting requests from people to write a sequel to it, because some people have enjoyed it tremendously. It's about a young girl that's on the autism spectrum. And yet I never mention in the book that she's on the autism spectrum. I just simply give, her characteristics and her traits and let the reader figure that out. And the reader does figure it out. But that book was published in between those two procedures, in between the angiogram and the actual full open skull surgery. And that, to me, was so thrilling to have that book published at that time. And, of course, I had to face reality. Even though I was in very good hands, I didn't know if I would make it through the surgery okay.
Yeah. I have that book, and that's not in audio, is it? Because I have it. I'm going to read it.
It's not in audio yet. No, it isn't.
Yeah.
And
I was looking for it last night, right, to see. While we're talking about this, before we get into a lot of your writing, I'd like you to talk a little bit about your husband, because he got in touch with everybody that was wanting to know how you were doing, because, I got the message, and I think that's really important, because you had someone to help you through this, and a lot of people aren't that lucky. So talk a little bit about how good that was.
Oh, I couldn't have done it without Bob. I'll tell you, he is so wonderful in so many ways. I mean, with my books, he does all the back office work.
But he cared enough to let people know how you were doing. And that's really
let me tell
nice.
You, yes, Marcia, because you and I were going to have a chat in the program, and then the surgery came up and we had to postpone. First of all, let me start by saying, obviously, Bob is just absolutely wonderful, and he was so patient and so encouraging and so caring and so loving throughout all of this, and as he always is. But he's not a cook. Let me say he's not a cook. And I thought, well, I don't want to be eating pizza every night while I'm recovering. So I cooked up 6 weeks worth of food, you know, soups and
wow.
vegetables and chicken and you name it. Stews. I froze them in containers and I labeled them and I gave him. It was 2 pages. The list was 2 pages long.
Yeah.
And I said, we will decide or you will decide what we eat that day and you'll pull it out of the freezer. and then, of course, he could handle heating it up. He could handle. And it was, he was just, Marcia, tell you, he was so loving and caring that I never even broke down to cry. Because I felt that I was in such good hands, that I had Bob, and I had a good surgeon, and I had a good medical team. And I look back now and think I was just so very fortunate in so many ways.
Yeah.
But also Bob was just, and of course Bob ran all sorts of, you know, he took me to the hospital every time I needed to go. And of course, they had to check me after 6 weeks, after I, you know, after the first 6 weeks that are pretty critical, because you can, if something goes wrong that they're not aware of, that's when it's most likely to happen. And you can go into, you know, you can have seizures because they've worked on the brain. You can have all sorts of, and Bob was just always there. And there was only one time I think he had to go somewhere, and we called a neighbor to come over. And people are amazed. We did not have nursing assistants in the home for those 6 weeks, or at least the first 3 weeks. But no, Bob was just superb, absolutely superb. And I can't, you know, I'm just so fortunate.
Well, there's a story in that. There's a story in that. That's for sure.
There is.
Because, you know, that, I mean, that matters. You know, I think that when people have things, you know, illnesses or, you know, where they need some help, you know, especially like women, we do everything. You know, we could do 100 things at one time. And then the thought of not being able to is a scary thought, because we always take care of it. Well, not every woman does, but a lot of women do take care of a lot of things. You know, and when our husbands are sick or our children or whatever, and it's a worry sometimes of who's going to take care of us, you know, so that's important.
Yes, and throughout that time, when I say I didn't cry, it didn't mean that I wasn't scared. There were times I was scared out of my wits, you know, having brain surgery, not something you ever want to have or not something you want to wish on anybody.
No, that's scary. Yeah.
It is very
scary.
But because of the nurturing environment that I was in, I just never did cry. I was, and Bob later said, "Do you know that you never cried?" Now, so it was, it was an extensive challenge because it did last for a while. And of course, the other thing was that I was not supposed to have communication with very many people. That is, I had to let my brain heal, which meant that I couldn't do very much reading. The neurologist said at first, you don't even want to watch any TV programs because it will exhaust your brain. And that I found that to be true. Yeah, I could watch some innocuous little program, and then I would have to go in and lie down. And because it was just too much for the brain. And then slowly, of course, you know, one day at a time. And then at the end of 6 weeks, I was able to, you know, that I was in bed that much. I would walk around a lot. And they did say that walking was going to help me a lot.
Oh, they did? Yeah, to keep your blood flowing and everything. Yeah, probably.
Yes. Yeah. And the last thing to do. And now I'm back to exercising a lot more, and I'm doing weight training, which I'd never done before, but they said that the weight training would be very good. So Bob and I, there again, Bob, is going with me. We have it. We go in twice a week and we do it together.
Well, I think that's, you know, that, I mean, because a lot of times people, you know, it's that's part of your recovery. If you have the right people helping you, I mean, even with therapists and things like that, if you have the wrong physical therapist or whatever, you know, the journey of people having illnesses could go either way, because you really, you know, have to have people that know what they're doing. And sometimes you don't realize that, you know, if they're good or not, till when you're done with the therapy, you go like, what did they do for me? You know, and though in your case, thank goodness, and then now you're still exercising and keeping up. So that's a really good thing. But I think there's so much that got, you know, that gets involved with, you know, when a person is not well. I think people, you know, that's why what we were talking about before is people, I try to do this, and I try to tell my family members also that not to look about in the future, but to kind of enjoy the day for what it is, not for what you don't have, but for what you do have on that day.
There's so much wisdom in that, and that is absolutely true. And if more people would just live that way, it would be wonderful because we worry so much about, oh, I've got to do this, I've got to do that, and we run around and don't take time to smell the roses. And it is important to slow life and do things like that on a daily basis. You know, it can be 5 or 6 minutes in the morning. Yeah. It can be a couple of minutes, you know, when you're having lunch. It can be, but we all need to have a little pause and appreciate the things that we have in life.
Yeah, and I think, you know, during COVID, it was very difficult. People were in the house and they weren't doing things. So, you know, and I had many shows like about talking about COVID and everything like that. So people, because their mental state was not good, and, you know, exercise, eating right, those things help. You know, and when you have an illness and you're getting better, those things help too. So those are, everything works together. You know, you can't not have good nutrition or exercise when you're recovering. If you don't do those things, you will not recover as well. And, go ahead, say, what were you going to say? Because I know that's what happened with you, like you just said. No, I just think it's important for people to do that, you know, because even if you have something, they do say that when you exercise and eat right, and if you, people get things, they tend to recover better than people that don't. You know, it's not always exercising to lose weight. It's exercising for your whole body and your mind.
Yes. Yes, that is correct. And they're finding that exercise is so important for so many aspects of life, not just keeping your weight under control, but it's, I've read tons of articles where people that exercise are less likely to get dementia or Alzheimer's in old age versus people who don't exercise.
And I think it's all those things, you know, and you traveled before for your company. So let's talk a little bit about your past as far as your career. And then I've had a lot of people that are authors now that did not do that before. You had a whole career, a big one,
with a wonderful company that was that's Johnson & Johnson. And the first 6 years that I was with them, I traveled the world for them. And then I was with them for 2 decades. And then I was promoted up to CFO of Johnson & Johnson Mexico. And that's the country that I'm originally from. So it was wonderful for me to return to Mexico in a position like that at a time, this was in the early 1990s, at a time when a lot of Mexican women did not have those kinds of opportunities. And there were universities, there were 2 universities that invited me to speak to different groups in their student body, particularly women, because I was serving as a role model. You know, this is what a woman can do in life if she wants to. And that didn't mean that I gave, having a family, I had my son. And then, of course, I moved on up the ranks and so on, but I did travel a lot. I've been to 98 countries around the world, And that's some of the information now that those cultures, because I'm just passionate about, they're so interesting, and how each country can have its own culture. Well, even different regions within a country can have their own subculture. And I'm always interested in that. And I can try to convey that in my novels, in my Nikki Garcia mystery series, because I place Nikki, the protagonist, in different places, in different countries. And although she's been in the U.S., when COVID hit, I was going to be going to Hong Kong. Bob and I were going to travel over there so I could do the research that I needed to do. I've done a lot of online research. And we were going there so that I could get the feel for the culture a little bit more closely than if I just, you know, did the online research. And then COVID hit, so we couldn't go. We had to postpone that trip. We ended up canceling it later. So we went to Miami, and I had been to Havana, Cuba, a few years before. And I thought, well, Havana and Cuba have such a connection with people that have, with Cuba that have come to Miami. So I wrote a book about that instead of writing the one in Hong Kong. I still haven't written the one in Hong Kong because I haven't gotten there yet.
Naturally travel, you know, because a lot of people don't travel a lot, and the people that do travel a lot, their writing is a lot more flavored. I don't travel as much, and I know that it's better if you do travel because you do get the flavor of how people live, and it's different, and you have to, and you know it when you see it.
Yes,
but
and
in
that's
a book, you don't see it as much online as you would if you're in there. If you could go.
That's right. That's right. And one of the biggest compliments that I get as a writer is when people say to me, I read your book that's placed in Barcelona, Spain, and it reminded me so much of being in Barcelona. I was there two or three years ago. And it just reminded me of being there. And that, to me, is the greatest compliment.
That's exciting.
I write.
That's always exciting for a writer to hear that. That never gets old.
No, you're right.
I want to talk a little bit. Let's talk about Stolen Diaries a little. You know, how did you come up with that character?
Well, that's a very interesting little story. Well, Bob and I were in Budapest, Hungary, and this was in about 2017. And we were staying at this lovely old hotel, and they had piano concerts every afternoon. And one afternoon, we took the time, stopped to smell the roses, and stayed for the concert. And I started getting, as writers often do, this idea of a young girl playing the piano with her grandfather. There were no children there, and the piano player was not a grandfather. But for some reason, this image just kept coming back to me. And I'm not a plotter. I don't plot my novels out. I just fly by the seat of my pants, and I start writing. And then by the time I finish a manuscript, I have a halfway coherent story. And then, of course, I go back and edit. Of course, I have an editor. But I don't sit down and plot. I thought, this is my time to plot this story out. And I took 6 weeks to plot, and I could get nowhere plotting. I was going to set this story in Budapest because that's where the story came to me, and it was going to be about a little girl and her grandfather, and it just was going nowhere. So I put it aside, and I brought out Revenge in Barcelona, the one I just mentioned that takes place in Barcelona, Spain. And then I also wrote Missing in Miami. And then I thought, well, COVID was still going on, so travel wasn't possible. So I thought, well, maybe I'll go back to this, because that story of a little girl with her grandfather just stayed in my mind. And so I thought,
that's what happened.
I'll give it a second. And what I did was I listened to the character instead of trying to force my thoughts, because I was going to write a ghost. And I listened to the character. She told me that she was on the autism spectrum. that she had a difficult relationship with her mother because her mother couldn't deal with her brilliance, with the child's brilliance. And father just wanted a normal child. The grandfather, because the grandfather is there, he wanted her to be the next Einstein. And the little girl just wants her mother's love and acceptance. But she's very close to the grandfather. But the story did not stay in Europe. Jasmine, the protagonist, the little girl, took me back to Mexico, took me to an area of Mexico that's not as well known by tourists as other places. And it's in central Mexico, not too far from Mexico City, actually, just a couple of hours outside of Mexico City. But a wonderfully rich area with a lot of archaeology and lots of arts and crafts. And the little girl grows up being very close to her grandfather, and she's a math genius, and she plays the piano. And it's a coming-of-age story with a lot of family secrets that's what, obviously, the story is about. The little girl Jasmine wants to uncover the family secrets. And true to her grandfather's desire for her to be the next Einstein, she gets a scholarship to Princeton University. And that's where the book ends, is in she's going to the University in Princeton.
Well, I think, family, I do write a lot about family, and, the series that I wrote with the Warrington Legacy, their family. I do like that. I noticed in my own writing, even a lot of my children's, a few of them, the grandparents mean, I have grandparents in a lot of my books. Because I think they're so important. It's possibly because I had great, I had grandparents, but I had one specific one, my grandmother, and I learned so much from her. And she lived till 101, so in my head, she's there. And how important that was to me. So I think, is a lot of TV shows now, a lot of movies, they show the grandparents in it a lot because grandparents matter. It's a different kind of relationship than with the parents. Yeah, it's just different. And I think it could be very beautiful and it's not that you don't love your parents. It's just there's something special, I think, about a grandparent. So I think that's always an interesting topic, and I think more and more people are liking those kind of stories.
I think you're
right.
Because
it brings them home.
It does, exactly. And it brings us back to things that are really important about family. And I think that's very important.
And the autism spectrum is an interesting one too, because there's a lot of people that probably were never diagnosed have that. They enlarge the spectrum.
You are correct. You are absolutely correct. And we owe a lot of things to those people that have been on the high-functioning end of the autism spectrum. They call them Asperger's. Now they're just calling it one continuous spectrum. And people like Einstein are presumed to have been on the spectrum. There are Marie Curie, who, of course, was the first woman to get a Nobel Prize for physics.
Right.
She was presumed to be on the autism spectrum. And then people come from all walks of life. You have soccer players that be on the autism spectrum, and they can be on the high function.
And I think there's a play now. I think I saw somebody on TV talking about there's a play with everybody in the cast is autistic at some point, and they explain things, and the play surfaces around, everybody, how they get through it, and they're all probably different. I never saw the play, but I heard them talking about it because there are so many people now diagnosed in that particular, years ago, they didn't diagnose it, so people didn't know, and sometimes people thought they were strange. But that's not really true. They could be so bright and know so many different things, like Einstein. I mean, look at him, right? You know, and there, naturally a person like Einstein couldn't be the same as everybody else because he had certain drive that made him do things the way he did it.
Yes, and he had not only a brilliant mind, he had a most amazing imagination that he combined with all of the technical aspects that led him to, you know, the theory of general relativity. He used thought experiments, and those thought experiments were just using his imagination to see things in his mind that back then he didn't have the computing power that we have today, obviously. So he had to do it in his mind. And the world owes him so much in, you know, what he did in physics is amazing and all the things that have come out, you know, because of his findings and his
experiments.
There
was a documentary. I don't know if you saw it. I think it was a series. I think it was actually on National Geographic. I think it was about Einstein. It was really, really good. I think it was a couple of years ago. Some of those documentaries and some of these series are incredible because they really delve into people that you would not know anything about other than they were brilliant, but you wouldn't know their background like they do now when they have a lot of these documentaries and series about these people.
That's correct. I agree. And I did watch that, and I thought it was fascinating.
It was really good. Yeah.
Yes, it was fascinating. And it's interesting to me how they can go back now with all of that information and analyze it and say, we're pretty certain he was on the autism spectrum. But one of the characteristics, of course, is the focus that those people have. They are so focused on what interests them that they are relentless about pursuing it. And that's what creates greatness. You know, you don't become by just doing things, you know, haphazardly. You become great because you are in a field, because you're focused and because you're pursuing it with passion and with the love that you have for that field.
But sometimes, unfortunately, the happiness of being with others goes, you know, that's a lapse of it. You know, that doesn't happen because they're so occupied. They want to be occupied with their family too, but they can't because they just can't concentrate on other things because that's what they see, like, you know, in their mind. It must be incredible to be like that, you know, close your eyes and just all these things come.
And that's the downside because quite often don't have good interpersonal skills. And, of course, that's one of the things I included in Jasmine because I had to do tons of research on autism. And one of the things that I gave her was one of the traits that I gave her was that she didn't have good interpersonal skills and really couldn't relate with people her own age because she was thinking about building a space rocket when, other people broke.
Because it's a very specific, you know, type of, when you're making a character, you know, I think people, you know, when you're not a writer, I don't think you actually understand how we come up with this. It just happens. Like you said, like your characters take you places. That's what happens. You know, we start. But a lot of times if I try to write an outline and try to write notes, I do that. And then when I get to the computer, it comes out a whole different way. And if you don't, something about when I sit at the computer, the story just evolves. But when I'm just trying to plot it out, like I can't seem to do that right because the characters kind of have their own voice and they take you. It does sound strange when other people, you tell people this, but that is how we write stories, a lot of us. It just happens. The characters, we follow.
That's right. And if we try not to avoid that, we end up with no story, like I ended up at first with Stolen Diary.
Right.
And then when I had a character with me and I listened to her, I got what I thought was a wonderful book, a wonderful story.
Yeah, because that's what happens. It's a good story. And that is what happens. It just, like, most people don't just sit down and they just write it out. It doesn't happen that way. It happens to us like we'll have a, they're part of us while we're writing them, and then that's when you write notes or things, because if you don't write notes on them, then you forget that. Because they think, and we have to put those that down when we're thinking it, because it won't come back to us.
They're
in my head a lot of times.
I
don't know
have
how good that is or not, but it's in my head.
That's right, but I've gotten up in the middle of the night when I think of something or I have a dream about something and I think,
yeah.
Oh, that works great in this story.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just write scribble a sentence or two, because by morning I will forget about it. And
that's
it's such
right.
a wonderful thought that I...
Right.
And
it just doesn't come back. I don't know why that is. It does not come back. You know, because sometimes you go, I know I was thinking something, but even if I write a few words, I can get it from that, just from writing
yes.
a few words. Yeah.
Exactly.
But, you know, and that's what happens. That's how you make good characters. I think it's important, you know, that when people are listening to the show or whatever, you know, I try to tell them, you know, don't, like everybody else, you can't write like everybody else. Just because you see the way somebody writes, you have to write your own style, and each character you have is a different style. They're not, none of my characters, even though I have a lot of romantic characters, like, you know, rom-com and their family characters, they're not the same. They're individual. None of them are the same.
Yes, because...
And I don't know how
believable.
That happens, but it does. It
yes,
does.
But to be believable as a story, we need to mimic real life in the sense that no
yeah.
two of us are exactly the same. So we our characters
exactly.
have to be... that way in our stories too.
Right. And,
well,
you know, and I think naturally with your experience though, your characters, I mean, you've met tons of people, you've been tons of places and you've had a lot of experiences. So that is a good way to describe an author that can really come up with a beautiful story because you've got it all.
Well,
matters.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you. That's, yes, those things really help because we do need that kind of variety in order to then include different things in our stories that can be very interesting to the reader.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Well,
that's what it's about. It's the character. It is the character. The character matters. You know, you can have the most incredible adventure, but horrible characters, people aren't going to like that. The characters have to have a heart, they have to have a life, they have to have likes and dislikes, and they have to have had some kind of conflict inside of them a lot of times, which we all probably do.
Yes, because all of us do, and all of us have complex lives in one form or another, and our characters need that too.
So will you be doing another one?
Well, I just had one, another Nikki Garcia, that's Nikki Garcia number 5,
right.
that was
right.
published the 8th of February, the 8th of this
yeah.
month. So our Stolen Diary came out in January of last year, and then now I have another Nikki Garcia that just came out this month. And that one is in the U.S. It's placed in New Mexico and Colorado. And the reason for that... was primarily, again, that I couldn't travel. You know, I'd had this major surgery, and the doctors didn't want me to do a
no.
lot of airlines. So I was
no.
completely, you know, back to myself. They certainly didn't want me getting on a plane for a 10-hour flight somewhere.
Yeah.
Because if anything's wrong, you know, it'd be difficult up in the air.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, well, right. And you know, it's just the waiting in the airports, you know, it's 3 days, you know. Going there 2 hours early, and then if I could just go like to the airport and just get on the plane, but that's not how it is. You got to sit there, and then they go, oh, might be delayed. This might happen. And that, you know, so I think that's for people that don't like to fly, what's going on now makes us even more nervous. So I think that's an issue. And with COVID, you know, from what I've heard from a lot of people, nobody's wearing masks, but I do hear people are coming back with COVID. So I guess they're not wanting to think about that, but that is what is happening. They're pretending it's not happening.
It is.
They're pretending it. But they go like, oh, everything is fine. And if you have COVID, you can go out in one day. So I don't really understand this. And I think that, you know, when you're traveling, it should be an enjoyable vacation, right? I mean, unless it's business or that you have to do something. But what's happening now is a lot of people are getting sick when they go to a place. So I think it would just be smarter if they would, you know, have some more rules, because who wants to be somewhere that, and you're not even with your own doctors or anything or people you know, or, and you're sick. And that, and then they go back on the plane because they, some of them say they don't want to spend the money to stay where they are. So now they go back on the plane with COVID. So I'm hoping they straighten some of those things out, because that makes it, it's not desirable to fly then.
No, it isn't. But, you know, oh, Bob, I don't want to catch COVID in another country for that reason. I want to be and I don't want to, regardless of how much it costs or whatever, you need to, for something like that, you need to be comfortable that you know your doctor, that you know your care provider. And then, you know, you're not going to, you know, you can't be doing that if you're, you know, 12 hours away by you know, jet.
No. I think this will be better. I think eventually this will get better, I'm hoping, you know, because, you know, but there are different forms of all this, and we can't, all these diseases and these bacteria, you know, I mean, this is what's happening now. So I think it will get better, hopefully, you know, and people will travel. You know, people are traveling, but most people that are traveling are thinking, they were thinking that they want to do the right thing, but they're not doing the right thing. They're thinking about it, but they don't want to. And so that's a problem.
Because, yeah, Marcia, when I travel, the last thing in the world I want to do is get sick and pass my germs around to everybody else. It would be very irresponsible of me. So it's a very different world now.
It's different. Listen, when I worked in hospitals and I worked in pediatric offices and whatever I did, we didn't wear masks, and because the bacteria were not as severe as they are now, because otherwise everybody would have been sick all the time that were working, the doctors, you know. I mean, nobody wore masks. We didn't wear gloves. I mean, we did in a hospital, yes, but I didn't wear masks, you know, in the hospital unless you went into somebody that you needed to put a mask on, but otherwise you didn't. So, that's how it was, but this is how it is now. So, you know, and I think for writing, you know, naturally it is great to be at the place, but good thing about the internet. I'm actually thinking of maybe going to the library a little more now. I haven't been to the library in years. But I thought, maybe I'll just go to the library because I could think there. I always used to be able to go there and think really well, because when I was sitting in the library reading or writing, even by longhand, I didn't think of anything else. I just wrote. And that's what happened. Yeah, and a lot of people during COVID, they went to write they couldn't write in the coffee shops anymore. And that's where people get their thoughts. So many people were upset about that because that's how they did it.
Yes. And, you know, Marcia, I've said many times that if I had not been a writer, COVID would have been much more difficult. The COVID period, I have not caught COVID. At least I haven't caught it that I know of. But But I'll tell you that if I had not been a writer already, the COVID period would have been extremely difficult.
I know. Because that's true. Because I wonder, you know, because having something like, you know, people in your mind when you're writing and things like that keeps you occupied. And during COVID, I had all the shows, you know, for years. For the first time when I had the COVID, I go, who wants to be on the show? And we had people on, and we were talking, thinking we didn't know how long it would last. How could we stay home for a week? And then everything happened. So I think, you know, but I think this is life now. So I think, you know, where do you write? In your house? Do you write in your house, or do you write outside, or
in the nice weather? Like right now, I'm in my office. And we're in a community where there are some little ponds, and I can look out over a couple of the ponds, see the egrets and the gray herons blue herons, and I can see turtles at the side of the pond, and all of that just brings such joy to me, because of course as I'm using the computer, I need to look out and kind of rest my eyes, and it's such a beautiful area. But I have a I always have to have windows wherever I'm working. And
I know. I do know that. Yes, I get it.
We're in Angel Fire. We have a nice little library up there. Of course, the town's only a couple of thousand people. But when we're there for the summers, the library is a nice little library, and they have wonderful programs for children. And it's so interesting to me to see how libraries can be such an important part of a community when you
yes.
have the right people working there
yeah.
and the right people, the right programs. And they've always invited me to talk about my latest book. And it is just such a joy to see that libraries
well, I think,
can...
Well, I think people like authors. I think people like to talk to authors. And what a big mistake a lot of these libraries are doing and bookstores are by not having authors there. That's I hope they start again. They're opening four new... Barnes & Noble in the Chicagoland area. They took them away. Now they're bringing them back. Because I do think people will go.
I
believe that
so.
They've had enough now. I think they've had enough because, you know, everybody's on their phone. And then even myself, I'm reading on – I used to say, how do people read on their phone? And then I'm reading this, and I'm on my phone more than my computer sometimes. I'm going, why am I doing this, you know? And I'm trying to – it's like you get addicted. And marketing and all of that a writer has to do, and it's a lot. So mostly it's important to get the stories out. And so Barnes & Noble and all these places, if they have more book signings and the libraries do, I think people will come for that.
People
they like
do turning out for those types of things. And as I mentioned, I've done 8 book clubs so far this year, and it's amazing to me, and that there only one was by Zoom, okay, and that was because they weren't here. They were in Central Texas, and I'm
yeah.
obviously 4 hours away, so we agreed that
yeah.
I would talk to them by Zoom. And that camaraderie that you get with a group that's there in
yeah.
a room is so much better than
oh, yeah.
over Zoom or reading something or seeing something
yeah.
on your iPhone. It's not the same. I agree, Marcia.
No, it isn't
and
the same. It isn't. So maybe it'll change back to that if they're starting to, you know, do that. That's good. So you were at the book clubs? Is that what you did, book clubs?
Yes. I do a lot of book clubs, yes. And
so where did you find them? You find them in the area? Did you find them in your area?
Well, they find me, or Bob finds them. It's word of mouth. I've gone to Bay City, which is south of Houston by a couple of hours. And I've gone to other places around Texas, and it's word of mouth. Bob started out by promoting me for book clubs with different people that he knew, and then it's just grown from there. And it's just amazing how people, and I have found that these groups that I've done this year are happy to be back together as a group. And yes, COVID's still
yeah,
out
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
But we can't stay closed up forever, and people
no,
are starting
cannot.
To.
Right, exactly. And that's why I'm hoping the libraries will start that more. And, you know, and as you said, with children, you know, it's really important with children and libraries. They should be at libraries. It's important, you know, and that's why I think a lot of people might be turning towards some of this again, because we've lost a lot by not having that in lives of, you know, especially for children. They, you know, being in groups, listening to stories, I think it's important. So I'm hopeful that this will, you know, continue on. It looks like if they're opening more bookstores, that might be something to think about.
That's a good sign. I'm very happy to hear that.
I think so. Yeah, well, we'll see how that goes. All right, so you're writing again, and which is great. Not again, but you're still writing. So hopefully you'll come back soon, and even maybe you'll come back on a discussion. You know,
that
with Eleanor,
great.
So we'll have a discussion. Yeah, and, I'm so glad that you are back, and you sound fabulous, not good. And this is, you know, it was really good that you talked about that at the beginning, because I think people always think, oh, this may not happen to me ever, and nobody knows that.
That's correct.
There's just
Marcia.
No way
you,
that we can know. But look
yes.
at how you've done. I mean, last year was last year. Now you're into a new thing now, which is good. You're writing. You're going places and you're going to travel, you're going to do things, and you feel good. So, and
I do.
You know what, and it's important to tell people what happened to you because they cannot be as scared if something happens to them.
That is key right there, Marcia. I love those words because what you said is key.
Yeah. Well, on that note, but I am so happy. I really am, you know, and that's why when they said, oh, something's wrong with the phones, I'm going, oh, my goodness, I'm waiting for this interview. I can't have it. All right, we'll knock wood that we had that. I'm always knocking wood because I'm so superstitious. It's unbelievable. Well, that I did get from my grandmother. That's one of the things I wish I didn't have as much. But it's still with me. Maybe that's why she's still with me, because I'm so superstitious. What can I say? All right, thank you, and feel well. Keep going, and let me know. Well, I'm going to read it, but so are you thinking of Stolen Diary going to be in a audio or?
Yes, eventually, but it's not going to happen probably till next year. I've got so much to catch up on, and I need to. There's some others that are ahead of that one, so far as getting.
Do you use the ACX? Do you use the Audible one? Is that what you do? Use Audible?
That's right.
Me too. Yeah, and unfortunately, you could ask people questions, but I'm not sure right now anymore. This is what's happening. You have to go online, and then they give you, you ask a question, then they ask you another question. By the time you're done answering all those questions, you don't even care anymore. So, they used to be able to call. You could call Audible. You could call these people, but it's not as easy as it was, you know, to call people that to get the answer. But because I use ACX too, you know, but, all this, it takes time, you know, and I think people don't realize how much time this takes. It's not easy.
People don't realize how hard authors work. Authors work very hard. We really do.
And they do. Yes, we do.
Yeah. And
that's why I keep telling people. And I keep saying to everybody, okay, so then if we have to keep giving our books away like for 99 cents, $1.99, I mean, so this is a plea to tell people, buy the book from somebody. You know, I mean, it's $2. You pay more for coffee. One somebody was on my show years ago and they go, why are people paying so much for coffee and they won't even buy a person's book? I go, well, that would be a good question. And you know what? I never forgot that because it's true.
It is.
I mean, it's unbelievable. So what can I say? We'll leave on that note. But I'm so happy that you came on, and take care, and I'll get in touch with you and you'll come on soon again, okay?
So much, Marcia. Just love being
and
on
thank
your program.
You to your husband. Thank you to your husband for
thank
keeping
you.
Us informed at the beginning. Okay, take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Okay, bye.
Bye.